Welcome back to the Who Stone Foundation podcast. I'm Bianca Stone. I'm here with our three visiting poets who came to read at the Rouston Foundation reading series in Winooski last night, brought down the tiny house, and we're going to talk today about their most recent books, how those books came to be, and read some poems from them. So welcome, John James, Jasmine Dream Wagner, and Gabrielle Dawn.
You can say
hi.
Hello.
Yeah. I'm like sitting here with my three dolls. So John, your book just officially came out, what, 3 days ago?
Yeah, on the 4th.
Yeah. So The Milk Hours was selected by Henri Cole for the Max Ritvo Poetry Prize and was published by Milkweed Editions. It's such a gorgeous book, and similarly to Gabrielle's book, has some images in it, which I'd love to talk about too. Maybe we'll start by you reading the title poem, The Milk Hours.
Sounds
and
good.
Go from there.
I'll be excited to talk about the images. People never ask about them.
You always get that from me.
Sounds good. The Milk Hours. We lived overlooking the walls, overlooking the cemetery. The cemetery is where my father remains. We walked in the garden for what seemed like an hour, but in reality must have been days. Cattail, heartseed, these words mean nothing to me. The room opens up into white and more white. Sun outside between steeples. I remember now the milk hours, leaning over my daughter's crib, dropping her 10-12 pounds into the limp arms of her mother. The suckling sound as I crashed into sleep. My daughter, my father, his son, the wet grass dew speckled above him. His face grows vague and then vaguer. From our porch, I watch snow fall on bare furs. Why does it matter now? What gun? What type? Blue smoke rises. The chopped copses glisten. Snow melt smooths the stone cuts of his name.
John James reading from The Milk Hours. Such a striking poem, and actually made me think of some of the poems you've been writing, Ben, about your mother passing a few years ago, and then sort of up against this new parenthood with the infant.
Yeah, I like your part, James. You kind of just have like a little list of, you know, my daughter, my father. The way it's all set up, you see this like movement in lineage kind of happening so fast.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it forms a kind of collapse. I mean, the occasion of the poem is actually quite true. I was living, and I still own this house, actually, in Louisville, Kentucky, right across from the cemetery. This sounds way more morbid than it actually is. but right across from the cemetery where my father is buried. And I was just standing on the porch one morning and sort of looking out, you know. I can't actually see his grave from there, but you can see the sort of the fencing of the, you know. Just realized, you know, they had inhabited the earth like 20 years apart, but here they were, both sort of like equally central to my life.
You say morbid, but I mean I don't think morbid. I feel like your book completely addresses that we're, you know, you have one poem called Sonic, and I feel like it totally addresses that underbelly of the earth and the sort of like beauty or the root systems of like plants, that those parts of that decay that we don't see, that you're sort of honoring that in this book in a really beautiful way. And you know, Ruth Stone is buried in the backyard in Goshen, and I feel like similarly there was like such a sweet tenderness in that, knowing that the body was so close, and that it was, even that it wasn't embalmed or anything, that it was a natural grave, that she was decaying naturally, and just these sort of like
On the spot, it's like in this weird little clearing where it's like behind this barn that collapsed. And you just like come across it and you're like, oh. And you see all these rocks laid out. And I thought I was going to ask Bianca to marry me by the grave. And in my mind, it was so poetic and fitting. And then it was like in the middle of February and I was like, this is really fucked up.
So he asked me in the middle of the totally animal destroyed house. That it was very awesome. Anyway, so I'll talk about us.
Just a little aside.
Yeah. Okay.
That's sweet.
But yeah, but talk about that a little bit. I mean, anything with the sort of, I feel like there's a lot about the corpse, the body, the underground in this book.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think for me, a big part of it was that I was doing a lot of gardening when I was writing it, you know. So, you know, what would be happening is I would be tilling the ground, you know, to put in plants, and you would realize there are all these bugs and therefore like all this like these sort of like microorganisms. And it just made me think of how even just in the dirt there's this entire sort of like ecology that is feeding what we actually see, you know, the things that grow. And of course, like, that reveals the kind of cyclical nature of those kinds of things. So that's, I think, the reason I was thinking about it was because I had this kind of very daily practice, right, that was like revealing to me slowly, and this was kind of my first time gardening, and so it was slowly revealing to me like these kind of cyclical energies that then were resurfacing through the sort of like emotional tenor or through the kinds of narratives that I was like sort of weaving through the book, which were, you know, in part autobiographical, you know, at points, you know, surreal, or in, you know, at other points kind of veer in other directions entirely. But I don't, you know, it was that kind of daily practice, I think, that
and
that
this got me was there. In Kentucky or
I wrote most of the book in Kentucky. Yeah, I mean, the oldest poem, you know, I started when I was living in New York and working on my MFA. But after finishing the MFA, I moved back and was adjuncting there. And luckily, I mean, Kentucky is cheap enough to where I was actually able to like get by on that. I mean, it wasn't a ton of money, but it wasn't a stressful life. And those were, you know, really good years. My daughter was born around the same time too. So there was a lot of kind of like, I was noticing a lot of death, but also a lot of, you know, life and rebirth.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Beautiful. So let's turn to, I feel like there actually are some interesting parallels with maybe confronting the family or the history in your book, Gabrielle. And certainly in such a different way. Maybe you could read us some excerpts from, and we'll come back, and you guys jump in too. I just want to have a sort of
introduce each person.
Yeah, introduce each person, and then we can sort of talk about different aspects of your book. But do you want to start off? Which poem would you like to start off reading?
Did you say something to do with my family?
I mean, yeah. If you
I remember, which was inspired by Joe Brainard.
Oh yeah, I love that book.
Or I have a sestina called Dubai Nights. His family, let me find.
Oh yeah, I liked the Dubai Nights one. Which is on 88.
Should I do that one? Okay.
Yeah.
Sestinas are a lot of fun. When you can't sleep at night. Dubai Nights. 3 a.m. in Dubai, we wait in line. Bleary-eyed, drunk, typical Arabian night. All bars pour free drinks for ladies, sexist. We seek pastries, Lebanese pizza piece. Diwali, festival of lights outside. Glowing strings shape flowers, stars above sand. Highways now where four-wheel drives ambled sand. 1991, we crossed borderline. Palm trees, soft dunes, constant strong sun outside. Little developed to invade dark night. The word Islam, Muslim, Salam means peace. Local friends don't all cover hair, sexist. Waiting with breasts, thighs exposed, men leer, sexist. Hazy horizons, shamal, storm of sand. Some women conceal their bodies for peace. Freedom, oppression, a subjective line. Galab Jaman soaked in syrup tonight. inside means different than outside. We wobble thick humid morning outside. The cute boys we take home shy or sexist. Card games and backyard boozing end of night. Prior kissing on fake island beach sand. Pakistani taxis past tall skyline. Expatriate friends get along in peace. Serbia and Croatia eat in peace. Sweet halva fills mouths, leave nations outside. Border belonging arbitrary line. Penis vagina define dual sexist. Gender and sexuality is sand. Undulating self dancing with the night. Virginity lost in Middle East night. Wala matsub is upon you peace. Time a regulated trickle of sand. When the sun is up, I avoid outside. I don't believe in gender. Am I sexist? Majnun and moving, I can't see the line. My mind is sinking sand, night without light. A line of poetry or E brings peace. Sexist people know my outside only.
Gabrielle Dawn reading from Living Without Skin, her new book from Gathering Up the Tribes, Fly By Night Press. So a very different landscape than John's gardening in Kentucky. We have a sort of... tell us a little bit about the landscapes in your book. I know you have a much different experience growing up than we do, I guess. tell us a little bit about how the landscapes appear in your book and how that reflects on your experience.
Mm-hmm. Landscapes are really important to me, even in my fiction. I think in Australia, the land is a very important concept about in our cultural identity. I grew up in Dubai, Singapore, and Australia, where they have all very different landscapes. Mm. So in Australia, you've got the beaches, all the birds, the dangerous animals. And in Dubai, you've got desert. Well, Australia has desert,
too. Yeah, I was thinking of Australia being, like, complete desert, but it's such a huge place. It's probably very different.
Very diverse. Well, Dubai is a desert on a beach.
Okay.
So, you're a desert on a beach.
Right.
And then in Australia, there's desert in the middle. But then
the coast is more lush. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So Dubai, Australia, and...
Singapore,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
What's up with... Sestina's, there's always the repetition coming back. And those words you choose, you must return to.
Yeah, the choice of the N-words that you... I love that you chose sexist as one of them. That's a fun challenge to keep using that word. It's funny because, like... I'm sorry, Ben, I want you to finish, but just had a thought. That, like, the first time you said it, there's so much weight to it. But then the more you used it, like, the more it changed. Like, every time you used it, it really changed in its impact. Like, not that it lessened or anything, but it just... That's really the most... That's a really successful Sestina, I feel like, when you choose something that it forces the word into us to confront the word differently every time. Mm-hmm.
Well, even with... It's interesting. You can read it kind of multiple ways where you can, like, you know, I'm just going to look at sexist and see how it changes. Mm-hmm. See how the lines change or, you know, sand or whatever it might be. But it's interesting with sexist how it goes from observing the people who are around who seem sexist and then kind of becoming a kind of meditation on gender and one's own thoughts and position on it. Like, that term at least seems to turn inward. Like, I'm around all these kind of sketchy people. What about me? Not that I'm sketchy or not, but just, you know, the seeing it and then, you know, you keep thinking about it.
Yeah, one of my literature teachers, Jackson Taylor, when he taught us Sestinas, he said you should have a balance of concrete and abstract words. So I think with my ending words of the six, I tried to have some concrete, something tangible you could hold in your hands, and other things that were philosophically hard to define. And then with sexist, I think, growing up in the Middle East... for you who know me, clearly I was not raised in an oppressive environment. Yeah. I don't think I could have come out of that environment. And I've lived in the Middle East since I was 7 years old. And then to move back to Australia and America and to see these perceptions of how women are treated in the Middle East.
Yeah.
Is something I wanted to explore.
Yeah, and how they, even that line about the peace.
Some women conceal their bodies for peace.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, with that, because for me, when I went back to Australia or America and I see you know, magazines like Barely Legal and a woman with breast implants on the street, I find that offensive to me as a woman. I feel that's oppressive. So is it freedom to be forced to expose your body versus cover your body? And then in the Middle East, it's actually very hot. So if you go to Arizona, they do, well, look what I'm wearing right now. This is like very thin cotton from the Middle East, and it's breezy, and you can be covered from mosquitoes, you can be covered from the sun.
You're
uncomfortable. Yeah. So it's not necessarily a choice that is imposed on you by religion or your father or your husband.
When I like this, I feel like this poem has a fun amount of food and like language from other languages. Some of these I'm not familiar with. I'm like gulab.
Jaman, yeah, that's like a Indian sweet. Yeah, it's like bright orange and curved like a pretzel and then dipped in syrup. Yeah, but like as you said, landscapes, food and landscape, I guess since I've moved around so much, those are like anchors of all my different cultural identities, because I may look this way, but then within me, what I choose to eat when I'm hungry shows where I was raised.
Yeah. And how you spell certain words. I was noticing in the book the British spellings and stuff.
Yeah.
Well, we always talk about our workshop about how, like, it's fun to look up words, but I feel like this could be you could have, like, a night with this poem where you're like, we're going to make these foods. We're going to eat them.
Well, Shamal is a sandstorm. So that's, I guess, about landscape, too. In Dubai, when it gets windy, sand blows everywhere. And then Wallah is, like, I swear. Like, a promise. Like, word.
Jasmine, the dream. I every time I say Wagner, I really want to say Wagner. So sorry if dramatic. I like pause every time I'm saying your name. Ashada Press, another word that I was telling John that earlier, that I always say Ashanta Press, but that's not what it is. I make up that there's an N in there. But I would love if you read a poem from On a Clear Day.
Great. I'll read a poem from a section of the book entitled Deserts, which is a meditation on seven different deserts that I visited during the course of a decade. This one is Los Angeles, one of my favorite deserts. In the beautiful air-conditioned home of the biofuel engineer and the installation artist, I write. Indistinct seep of habitat with no beginning, no end. Thinking of the harems of monarch butterflies, crossing deserts to migrate en masse. Bouquets of butterflies hanging from rafters like bundles of peppers and roses, in unexpected settlements due to cold winds and airplane traffic. I think of Los Angeles. I think of the hill I climbed late night in Echo Park to fetch my guitar from the car. How the animal parts of me, my primal brainstem, the invisible ears that slant atop my head, pricked up like solar panels. How the invisible eyes that hover above my hair blinked open like lighthouse beacons. How the invisible heart that beats above my chest like heat floats above sand was a quivering jelly. How I saw them before I saw them. How curious they were, lined up in the street to question me among the cars and the eucalyptus, the garbage and the recycling, like concrete garden gnomes in a semicircle, the wolves.
Love that.
Yeah.
Gorgeous. Jasmine Dream Wagner reading from On a Clear Day from Ashanta Press. I did it again.
You did it again.
I'm going to have to copy paste them.
Ashanta.
Mm-hmm. It's an H.
Ashanta.
What's so cool about the ending is, like, I thought, maybe just hearing it, I was like, oh, it's the thing you see before you see them is the butterflies. But you're like, no, it's the wolves.
What do you mean?
Well, I don't know, when I just hearing it out loud, you know, I was like thinking about the butterflies, and then
oh, I know the way the wolves come in, just there's something so like powerful about that, that simple ending. So tell me about the project of writing about different deserts. How did that come to be? Had you visited all these places, or is it just something you were interested in as a phenomenon on this earth?
I had visited all of these places. I was thinking a lot about the desert as a concept, and at the time, especially in escalating years of considering border crossings and the different walls that we throw up, and the way that we define the end of one thing and the beginning of the other, whether or not we include or exclude. I was thinking about how deserts, or any kind of ecological area or an ecosystem, there are no discrete boundaries. So on a map, you can see a desert, it looks yellow and it butts up against an orange or a green or a blue. But when you're actually there, there really is no way to draw a line in the sand. This is where the desert ends. And in all of these different deserts, there are all these different kinds of people, ideas, animals, winds, weathers, that cross borders. And in Los Angeles, that I was definitely thinking of the monarch migrations and the wolves that come into the city, and just observing some of that, and even the idea of new technology flowing in and flowing out. So a lot of that thinking, I think about those kinds of border crossings or boundaries as being very porous in a few of the essays throughout this book. So the first series is a series called Sunsets, but it's actually based on, I was attempting to review a sound art installation called Soundspill that was a Blutowitz collection, and thinking a lot about the cruelty of institutions, but also the idea of sound art, and that the installation was set up so that all of the different pieces bled into each other. So when you went into the room, you could focus on a piece, but then as soon as you start walking from one piece to the next, it becomes a cacophony of noise. And then also thinking about the noise of EFDR seeping through windows, or a pop song leaking, that that songs leak and that we text them, and that sound can never really be captured, and it crosses borders. And then also, like, there's another long essay called The Aughts, and it's about thinking about the concept of a decade, that the way that we organize time is always kind of leaking into the prior decade or leaking into the future. So thinking a lot about those kind of boundaries and different, like, riffing. I was basically riffing.
And you riff in such an interesting way in this book. I mean, I feel like it's completely born out of your love of essay writing. So you're combining this sort of like multi-layers and parallels between things in this book. It's poetry, but you approach it in many different ways. Have you always been a multimedia artist in the way you write poetry, or?
I've always, I'm a musician. I've dabbled in video making. I feel like, when I feel an impulse, I like to follow it. I like to allow that impulse. As far as crossing poetry with essay writing, I just feel like there are places where the prose needs to be prose and be lush and full and hit the boundary of the page. And there's sometimes where you need to break it, and that a line actually is so powerful, or being able to work spatially on the page, the way that it looks when you have, you know, concrete poetry is incredible. Formal verse, I'm obsessed with formal verse, writing metrically, thinking about the poem as a machine. There's times where you really need to do that in order to feel it, feel the propulsion. So thinking about craft in those terms.
Maybe a question for everyone is, for the books in question here, what made you decide on the multiple forms you brought in, even if it was image or
John, talk about your decision to use images in your book, and talk about, for the people who can't see right now, what those images are.
Sure. Well, First, to start actually with Ben's question, I mean, one of the really difficult things for me with this book, and part of what took me so long, is I've always written in lots of different forms. Like, I wish I was one of those poets who could just, like, write in tercets or something, right? Or, like, write in this kind of, like, you know, or in prose blocks. So they would all...
my form.
Yeah, right? Yeah. And it's, you know, then, like, I think it'd be much, for me at least, like, I'd produce a book much more quickly. But instead, what happened is I had all these other forms beyond the ones that fit into this book that just didn't quite gel with these poems. And so... I took a lot of those out, and they're kind of sitting, you know, on the back burner. I don't know if I'll end up, you know, publishing them in a collection or not. But the images, I didn't start doing them until, gosh, I think about 2000, like 2018. They were, I mean, one of the latest additions to the book. And I started because I was sort of stumped with poetry. I was kind of tired of writing poetry, and the book was close to done. I was kind of still shuffling poems around, but I wasn't writing a whole lot of new poems for it. There were a couple more after that. But I had seen a number of other poets. One of them, Rebecca Gale Howell, actually, in her book American Purgatory, that were using collages and sort of pairing them alongside poems. And I thought this would be a really cool sort of thing to kind of fill out the book. Like, it will add another dimension without adding an extra, like, poetic form, right? Without, like, you know, words kind of arranged in yet another way on the page. What I didn't anticipate, though, was what it would open up for me. I mean, first of all, I was drawn to the same kinds of images, and maybe this shouldn't be surprising, but I was drawn to the same kinds of images that I was, like, already dealing with in the book, so they seemed like a natural fit in that way. But then they also allowed me to bring in, like, images of machines, right, and like, maps, and... you know, and even in images that, like, aren't in here, schematics, that kind of thing. That, like,
it's interesting. The one I'm looking at, there's, like, ferns almost, like, on the
different bottom. In the final, because we have the proof.
Yeah, they're. I mean, the quality is a little bit better, but they're the same images.
They're still black
and
white.
Sorry. It looks like a schematic of some kind of tubular machine. And then flowers. So you put that together yourself, the kind of overlay.
Yeah, and that was the cool thing about doing the digital collages, is I was able to sort of, I was able to graft, like, images onto one another by adjusting the opacity or that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And you know, intersperse, you know, little bits of language, but to do so only sparsely.
Yeah.
And I just found a great resource. I mean, I was looking through the British Library's Flickr Commons page, and there are all these, like, really cool, like, bits of 19th century, like, etchings and paintings, and, you know, they're all open source at this point, so I just started, like, clipping bits of them, and they're amazing. There are just so many different types, I mean, I came up with way more than I could ever fit into this book.
Wait, tell us where you found the images?
The British Library's Flickr Commons page.
The British Library's Flickr comments page?
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Bless whoever manages that.
Yeah. What a fun job.
They're constantly just dumping new material into it, too.
Yeah. So, and is it high res?
They were high enough.
Yeah, high enough.
It was interesting because I'm just noticing, like, you didn't use these images as section breaks.
Yeah.
What brought you to that?
I thought about it, but I already had these kind of distinct sections, and I was trying to manage having enough poems in this last section, but I kind of had this was the section that had kind of too many different types of forms. Mm-hmm. So the problem was I had enough poems that I could fill it out with something, but it was like there was too much going on. Mm-hmm. So
I
the
feel
images
like that's like kind of indicative of the end of a lot of books where you're just sort of like dumping the other stuff
in, definitely. And in a certain way they all feel like they're of a part, but they like look so different or move so differently on the page that like just breaking those up and creating mini sections within a section,
a little space to breathe,
like worked really well for me.
But do you think of them as more of like a section break, or do you think of them as visual poems?
I think of them as visual poems.
And it's not like necessarily they're there to illuminate the poem beside it. It's its own thing.
They're their own thing.
Okay, so that's really interesting. And Gabrielle, you also have some images, collage images, in your book, and I thought what was really interesting about your book is your self-portraits in here. So tell me about your process in doing visual art and poetry together. Or your decisions in this book.
Yeah. Well, the first one, I believe you're talking about Lover, that was a commission for a Hallowzeen magazine, and I was thinking about witches. But I think using the image of myself, I went to a museum in Washington, at the photography museum, and it had a portrait of Walt Whitman.
Mm.
And it was talking about how he used the image of the poet and the persona to go alongside with his poems and his words. So that's something I'm definitely interested in. And if you can see the image with Lover, I'm in a bra, salaciously dressed, and I'm holding a pen, which, because it was
looks like a cigarette.
Oh, yeah. It's a, in my mind, it's a wand. It was, oh, my pen, cool. My pen is my wand.
I thought it was a paintbrush.
Yeah.
It's probably, it's up to the reader.
Up to the reader. Sorry, I shouldn't close.
But also these leopard print stilettos. Mm-hmm. That's, yeah.
Yeah. And if you know me, I'm usually shoeless or in
boots.
So it's not my usual.
And there's a persona being created.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And it looks like sort of something that's been handwritten on the wall.
It was, yes, it was. Yeah.
Okay.
I didn't really think it out, and that was on my wall for like months.
So do you want to just read that?
Yeah, sure. And you can see how intimidating people came over when they saw this on my wall. Above my bed.
Yeah. Yeah. Above your bed.
Welcome.
Like written in blood.
Yeah, I think it was black paint. Lover, I am not your muse. I mused you, I used you, I chewed you up and spat you into this poem.
So what I loved about this too, just sort of careen into talking about the specifics of this poem, but I do want to hear about the other one too, the other image too, but I loved how this idea of the muse, and I feel like it comes through throughout your book, is this idea of the muse sort of taking back control and sort of addressing the, maybe even the abusiveness of adoration by somebody else, that being somebody's muse can be very oppressive. And there's a lot of push and pull between the pleasure of eroticism, but also maybe the
violence
between lovers, and one person taking back control, and then at the same time celebrating a sort of sub-dom relationship. Like, I don't even know, you know? Do you feel like that? Is that this poem, like, do you play with that idea of...
Definitely. I think it's definitely about the idea that the woman is there for consumption, but the woman can also be there to consume.
Yeah.
And to gaze, not to be looked at. Like, in the history of art, you know, for a while, when women were painted, they were never looking at the viewer.
Interesting. Yeah.
In the first one, I think it's the Petit Déjeuner. Mm-hmm. She's naked at a picnic. There's one woman naked, and all the men around her are dressed, and she's looking at the viewer.
Wow.
And it's like the first time she was engaging with you.
Wow.
So I guess it's, you know, the woman looking rather than being looked at.
Yeah.
Too.
Powerful. And then the other image, electricity. This poem. Do you want to read that and talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Electricity does not always mean a connection. What is instant and easy is not always the most satisfying. Sometimes what I need is the moon and my own two hands.
I love this one.
Thank you.
Yeah, I love that one too.
It's cool to hear, like, you read it last night, and it's interesting to hear it at a reading and then to see the book version.
Yeah, so this... it's been previously published in a Dada Journal of Art and Poetry. So you're allowed to, they encourage art, and originally it was printed in color. And if you notice with each line, I changed the font.
Mm-hmm.
And then eventually for the lines, and my own two hands, it's handwritten.
Mm-hmm.
Mm, yeah.
And then again, it's playing with persona and images of the poet. A woman is taking a selfie in a mirror with a sex toy, though parts that, you know, should be censored are covered with Hello Kitty coloring book cutouts.
Yeah. Like, mostly fruit too.
Yeah, and it's actually colored.
That's the Hello Kitty bow. Yeah.
Yeah.
And a love heart.
Yeah.
Thinking about form on the page again and composition, in all your books, Jasmine, you don't have any visual images, but I feel like you do play a lot on the page with different forms, like you were talking about before, the prose, and some poems are very short lines, and just sort of honoring the poems as they came? Is that...
Well, tell me about the construction. Why the essay for this book? Why was that the proper form? Or the form that compelled you to write it, I guess?
I think that the essay and the prose poem are pretty closely interrelated in this book.
Mm-hmm.
In my first book, Rings, I did a lot more visual writing.
Mm-hmm.
And in my chapbook, Rewilding, some of the poems are much more visual, and I would work intuitively or conceptually with the way that words looked on the page. I really only worked in that kind of manner in one poem or lyric essay in On a Clear Day, and that was the section where I wrote about visiting the Nevada test site as one of the deserts in my desert series.
Mm-hmm.
And so in that poem, I speak about the experience of getting on the bus, and then they basically tour you around this, it's a 8 hours of touring all of the remnants of the nuclear testing era. And so they take you to where the doom town was, they take you to where the cages were, where they held pigs and exposed them to radiation. It's actually, it was an incredibly eye-opening experience. Anyone can go. You have to basically, you apply to the government, so you send them all of your information. It takes about 8 months, and then they'll assign you to a tour.
Jesus.
And you have to show up in Las Vegas, and they put you on a bus, and they'll take you around. At the end, there's a gift shop.
Wow.
Yeah, so
why do they apply to the government?
Just like the 9/11 gift shop?
Yeah, it's like the 9/11 gift shop.
Yeah.
I was at the Holocaust Museum, and I was like, what's in the gift shop?
Right.
I guess you can monetize anything.
Yep.
Yeah.
But one section of that poem, I was thinking about what does remain. And I was thinking that in terms of power, when we talk about erasure, we talk about forgetting. We talk about intentionally forgetting or culturally obliterating a language,
mm-hmm.
or these acts of cruelty, or their acts of apathy, that
mm-hmm.
If a language isn't practiced, it disappears. If we don't preserve certain species, they will disappear, and sometimes they disappear regardless.
Mm-hmm.
But in poetry, erasure signifies remains, and
mm-hmm.
so when you look at poets doing erasure work, they are selecting, and I think that it's incredibly affirming to think about erasure in terms of poetry,
mm-hmm.
because it is what remains on the page, and
mm-hmm.
that what we're selecting as far as images, it's what stays with us, or
mm-hmm.
it's what we're incanting or calling into being.
Yeah.
And so I was having that realization while I was touring, that I must write about it, because that is calling us into, it's keeping us aware.
Mm.
So thinking about erasure in those terms.
I wish you could read a part from that.
Let me find a part.
And John, you've done some erasures lately, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this is a bit more abstract than lyric.
But knowing the context now is very interesting here.
So the desert is unverifiable because the desert is erasure. Not the natural desert, not the desert of Choya, Palo Verde, and Saguaro. I mean the technological desert. As I write this, the Nevada test site's doors are open, courtesy of Google's satellites. I Google Nevada test site map, and servers produce a rendering of sand swathe and rectangular settlements. I click on a blue bubble pin, and a pop-up informs me. Area 51, Groom Lake. The airbase that you see here does not exist. In all symbols of power and control, there is erasure. For instance, in porcelain, there are no keys. Harmonium, wingspan, peonies, lily, lock, egg, colonnades, Shoshone, suede, reaper, fox, honey, test, proving daffodils, dow, mons, cavities for mica, choked with preparations, tower, Lockheed, garnish, easy, good, square, flank, Galileo, then axis. What endures for real? Liminality, disobedience. In power, erasure signifies obliteration. In poems, erasure signifies remains.
That section where it breaks down, is that erased from something?
It was erased from my notebooks where I was taking notes on things that I was seeing. And we weren't allowed to bring cameras, cell phones, anything electronic. But you were allowed to bring a notebook if you wanted to. So I brought a notebook and I was taking notes the whole trip.
Amazing.
Yeah, and they search you. So they actually go through your bag. They like pat you down. You have to put a radiation monitor clipped on your chest.
Oh my God.
That's so intense.
They don't want anyone taking any pictures, or they want to control what you see.
Wow.
Yeah.
And you can't leave the bus?
You can't leave the bus at all. No, we left the bus once, and it was there's a viewing platform on the Sedan crater, so you're able to leave the bus to stand on the viewing platform and look over the Sedan crater, which is one of the larger remains of one of the above ground nuclear tests, and it's a giant, giant dune. And there is a sign that that talks about how much radiation you're exposed to just by viewing it, and it's you're exposed to about smoking a pack of cigarettes.
Amount
by standing outside and then traveling around
for like 15 minutes or something.
Yeah.
Wow.
Jeez.
But I love this idea of all poems in some ways being erasures of the larger picture of what the poet has either experienced, witnessed, or is in communication with in that mysterious way that we are sort of recording something. And
like the potential of a prose page has been like condensed to these few words.
And what you choose not to say.
What you choose not to say.
And what you
absolutely
choose to take away is like, I mean, it's everything in poetry, and it's like a skill that you learn the more you write, right? I mean, do you feel like that? Like, especially like working on a book maybe and having to like let go of things in order for the book to be stronger, in order for it to really resonate, and being like, this was really important to me to write this, but it's almost like the bone in a soup where you take it out in the end. And it's, how was your editing process in creating your books?
I wrote two or three drafts of this book. In my original draft, there were other essays in it, and I chose to leave them out, and I think I was just trying to drill down to certain themes.
Mm.
So in a way, I was erasing my first manuscript, but
then
I was adding and editing up to the final deadline when Janet Holmes was like, it's going to the printer at noon, and you can't make any more changes.
One more poem.
I know, exactly. I'm a terrible tinkerer. Like, I just want to tinker constantly. And So
your poems never finish, only abandoned.
It's true.
It's so true.
Like, it's totally true.
Yeah.
I would still, if I had to.
Yeah, if you had the document open.
I still look at my book and I'm like, oh, I could change that. I could change. I should have expanded this.
Yeah.
You know. John, what about you? Your book's very slim. It's a slim volume.
Yeah. The version that was accepted was maybe 20 pages longer.
Mm.
That's a lot. Yeah. I mean, I had made some cuts right before it was accepted and had decided like this was like a much tighter version. It was the one. It was kind of funny because I had actually made a few changes. I was on a plane flight from Louisville to San Francisco, made a few changes, and thought to myself, okay, like, I've got it. That's like when I added the images in, and I was thinking, man, this is it. It's going to be this year. Like, I've been sending this around for a couple of years. And the plane landed, and I opened up my phone, checked my email, and I have a message from Daniel Slager, who's the publisher of Milkweed, that, you know, just kind of, it's actually sort of funny. It was this vague message that was like, Dear John, call me when you have a chance. I have some news. ... Whoa. I was like, oh, that doesn't sound like a rejection.
You didn't win.
You know, yeah. Yeah, right?
I just wanted to tell you personally.
Good luck placing your work elsewhere. Yeah. So I'd be like, that's the most personal rejection I've ever gotten. but yeah, so I had cut something like 20 pages out of it, even though a different version had been accepted. And so then I kind of ran that version by Henri. But And I was a little bit nervous at first that maybe the book was too slim, because it is a pretty short book. But I feel like sometimes when you kind of allow that space, you're allowing the poems that are in there to resonate more strongly. And so I don't know. And I also like short books.
Me too.
You know, I don't like reading that much.
Yeah,
like I like reading, but like I like reading small concentrated amounts. I guess that's why I'm a poet
You know, well-known, famous, beloved books are, you know, 60, 70 pages. And
true.
Or 40 pages.
Or was it the Rothke book that we were looking at where, like, it was his collected and it was like...
Yeah, it's just like a little thing.
It was like barely 100 pages.
Yeah, that's crazy.
But,
yeah.
Yeah. And how about you, Gabrielle?
For me, the first step that was the most difficult step, I think, in the whole process, was to create a document and then gather all my poems, my body of work, into one document.
Yeah.
Totally. And go through all my Moleskines, go through my Google Drive, my drafts, my Facebook, everywhere I have, just through my past publications and all my where I've been scattering poetry for years and years and years, and gather them all into one document without discrimination. Just put them all in one document and have them there, and then save that as a new thing, and then go through and start to cut. And I mean, cut, this is, I think, 144 pages, and that master document I created was over 600 pages.
Wow.
Like, it was
wow.
Huge. Yeah.
Wow.
So about cutting things
there's other books in there.
Not, you know, that was stuff when I was writing a poem a day. In my book I have The Daily Mirror, which is inspired by David Lehman.
Okay.
So that was writing a poem a day for a year. So I mean, while you do it every day, and I think it's a good thing to do, you don't necessarily want everyone to see that.
And this poem, it's called What Do I Want, and then it says 16 years old, 2002.
Yeah, so that one I actually wrote when I was
I was like, this, that's really interesting that you did that.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other interesting thing was Queen Elizabeth's speech, verbatim?
Yeah, well, I remixed it. So in it, she says, although I have the weak and feeble body of a woman, I have the heart and stomach of a man and a king of England nonetheless. But I've changed it and I made it, although I have the body of a woman, I'm, you know, I can, like, you know, Dorothy Parker at the Algonquin table, you know, you can sit with the greatest of men.
Okay, yeah.
And be equal to them in wit.
Right.
And writing skills.
I loved that.
But yeah, the What I Want poem, that was painted on my wall as a teenager.
Oh.
Yeah.
So you've been painting on your walls for some time.
For a long time. Except now I rent, so it was my parents' house.
Okay.
But no, I definitely grow art on the walls.
So maybe, John, can you read another poem from your book? I would love to hear another.
Yeah, sure. So I'll read a poem called Years I've Slept Right Through.
I love that line.
Thank you. Years I've Slept Right Through. The field is steeped with the violence of horses. Night descends blue hills, and I attempt to weigh distance as a calf tests its footing to the waterhole. On the front porch, my cat devours a hummingbird. He beats the brilliant body with his tufted paws. He breaks its wings, swallows whole the intricate bone house. Inside, the pilot light is burning. My sister's friend with the coal eyes is over. Gradually, I crawl into bed, aching for more light. In the dooryard, a young boy stoops to pluck feather from feather until his hands are sore. So prone to sadness, this thief. I take my glasses off and lay them on the table. The shadow of a tree rests inside my palm. This spring, I commemorate my father's death by tacking deer horns above the door. My hammer strokes disperse an assembly of hens waiting around for me to scatter their seed. A mile away, the river is abundant. It breaks its sudden excess on a limestone bridge. A big-axled wagon tips into the water where white mud washes the coachman clean. This is a custom he repeats every year, coming and going until his wheels give out, coming to wet his tongue. Dawn chalks over the horizon, rendering the sky a storm-blotched red. The outline of a cow appears on the hill and then dissolves into the fog. I follow her path with my ear, listening as a bell sounds out the trail. It is mine, this world of bread and skin and stone. Lay me in the field with all the fallen horses. Growing up in Kentucky, you become self-conscious of how many horses you have in your poems.
No, you're gonna save it for a good one.
Exactly, yeah. Right? And so that's when I allowed myself.
Yeah. I feel like the ending of this poem really sums up your book in a good way.
At one point, it was going to be the final poem in the manuscript, and then when I sort of shuffled things around, I kind of siphoned off that poem, Forget the Song, which is the one that now closes off the book. It had been the last poem in the first section that has a number of poems that kind of look and move a little more similarly to that one, and I thought it'd be a kind of nice, like, recursive gesture to sort of take this poem that feels like it's from the beginning of the book and then throw it back to the reader at the end.
Well, thank you guys so much.
Thank you for having us. Thank you, Ben and Bianca.
Yeah, thank you guys.
And any final words about stuff you're doing or you want people to know about or what's next? Besides, I mean, your books just came out, Gabrielle and John, but Jasmine, what are you doing right now?
What's next? I am a finalist for the Leslie Scalapino Award for Women Performance Writers.
Oh, sweet.
And there's going to be a staged reading on Tuesday in New York City at New Ohio Theater. Mm. Anna Kohler will be directing the premiere of my play in verse.
Awesome.
That has made it through the rounds of the contest.
Cool. So this is like the final round? Is performing it?
Yes.
Cool.
So a portion of the play, the first act of the play, was published in BOM magazine this winter. So if you're interested in reading it, it's BOM number 146, The Water Issue.
Yep.
We'll get a link in there.
I'm just really excited to work with Anna Kohler and 8 actors.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
That's so exciting.
So that's gonna be awesome. Tuesday.
Yeah.
I'm excited to do more. And I haven't written many plays in verse, but I've been working on this one for a while. So.
Mm. And John and Gabrielle are about to
go on tour.
Antidote Books in Putney, Vermont, and give a reading tonight.
Cool.
Mm-hmm.
And then back to New York City for Gabrielle, and back to you're continuing on.
Well, I'm going back to New York City and doing a sort of book party on Sunday, June 9th, 6:30 at the Living Gallery Outpost, if anyone wants to stop by. And then Gabrielle and I are heading out to Provincetown for a reading on the 11th, doing one at Riff Raff Books in Providence on the 12th, and then I head back to Kentucky to launch my book with friends and family.
That's so great. Well, thank you all again. And also, I have to say that Gabrielle is going to have a baby.
Oh, my goodness.
There's that. There's that exciting.